Salutations, listeners. Welcome back to Culture Made of Algorithms. My name's Owen Riley, and you're listening to the podcast that takes a look at our media consumption, the culture they produce, and societies left behind. In this week's episode, we talk about football, or, well, more accurately, the European Super League, and our current understandings of institutionalized football, which has made the game go from a grassroots sport, which we, well, play about with £5 balls as young children, to the multi-billion pound super institution, which boasts one of the largest audiences of any sport across the world. Now, why would a podcast about media theory even bother to care about football, a sport which involves you going outside? Media's mostly about being inside, right? Well, no. I mean, there's billboards, there are public performances which fall under media. And so I am going to be a little bit braggadocious here and open the scope of what media can be to say media's outside, football's outside, and therefore the two relate. But no, on a more serious note, the reason I'm talking about football on a media podcast is because, well, media has made, through television licensing deals, through radio broadcasts, through newspapers and magazines and social media profiles and marketing, media has made football go from a grassroots sport which we may play in our backyards and people's gardens and public parks on school playgrounds into a multi-billion dollar franchise which boasts potentially, depending on who you ask, the largest audience share of any sport across the globe. It's even being debated as to whether what sport might be played on the next colony of Earth should we ever reach there. Is it going to be football? Is it going to be baseball? Is it going to be some variation of the NFL? We don't know, but through the fact that we're not talking about lacrosse or golf, well, golf went to the moon, funnily enough, but the fact that we're not having those conversations or those conversations around those sports kind of shows how big and how important football has become to so many people. And it's a conversation we've had to revisit in recent weeks and months due to the destruction of the European Super League. In the following on from those conversations, we quickly learned that football meant so much more to so many different people. It had meanings which we didn't necessarily know it meant until those status quos were challenged. And so today I'm going to be talking to you about those changes and these meanings around football through Bruno Latour's Actor Network Theory. Now, if you are a follower of my YouTube live streams where we revise certain media theories in a little bit more detail, you would know that we recently talked about Bruno Latour's Actor Network Theory as this technology and sociological approach to things in something called an actor network theory, where actors, which are people, and actants, which are things, interact in ways which allow us to see how everything is somehow interconnected in some various way to create a system which gives meaning to the products that we use. Now, in a talk given to USC Annenberg, Bruno Latour talks about the Challenger, a space shuttle which sadly was destroyed in 1986. And he talks about how the pieces that made up the space shuttle were nothing without the bureaucratic system in which those pieces were able to be brought together. In so doing, the space shuttle, when pieced together and on that rocket and for a very few seconds, it meant the next step in space exploration. It was the next endeavor that humanity had not yet explored. And when the disaster took place and that space shuttle unfortunately exploded, a new meaning was given to those destructed parts. It showed us that space travel was still very dangerous, that the bureaucratic systems weren't perfect, nor were the physical components. And so the discovery that we had hoped Challenger would give, and the commercialization of which spaceflight should have taken far sooner, these sorts of anticipated meanings and given meanings and destroyed meanings all mattered in the context of space travel, of NASA, and of what would be the Challenger space program. And so now we manage to look at the European Super League as a similarly destroyed idea, which contained within it so many meanings and now takes on far more meanings now that it is destroyed. And yet both sets are entirely reliant on how we talk about, think about, and use football. But to set the ground level, what exactly is the European Super League? Officially founded on the 18th of April 2021, the European Super League plans to use 12 of some of the most famous clubs in European football as leverage against UEFA, that is the ruling body of European football, to create this magical, brand new and super exclusive continental league. Now, this idea isn't exactly a new one. Continental football has existed since the 1955 in the European Cup, also known as the Champions League. The European Super League has been floating around for decades now and changed hands and adapted as financial incentives grew and market share of football around the world grew also, till what is the latest idea that was pitched and was destroyed 2 days later, or at least we think it's dead. The Super League has this interesting way of being zombified and coming back in a new guise for us to find it almost unrecognisable, but it's fundamentally the same thing. Now, the Super League was going to be a fundamentally different beast to the Champions League. Financially, the 12 clubs who found the league would earn a guaranteed €300 million in a form of a loan, which they were going to pay interest on, and that was just for simply turning up. It was also going to be organisationally different to how UEFA and FIFA run the Champions League, as these 12 clubs would come under the presidentialship of one of these private investors to run the league. And in comparison, the Champions League is far smaller in the earning potential of these clubs, despite being a top flight football and argued to be the greatest league in world football. Clubs can earn up to €83 million for participating, so we have at least three times the earning potential in this new league. Now, seeing 12 of the most financially lucrative clubs leave UEFA's influence, there was a reaction, a big one too. UEFA, the Football Association, also known as the FA in England, the Premier League, the Italian Football Federation, the Serie A of Italy, and the Royal Spanish Football Federation, as well as La Liga, all issued a joint statement condemning the plan. So on one hand, we have the 12 clubs going on to found this Super League, whilst at least five leagues and five national bodies which organised those leagues came out in strong condemnation of it. But they weren't the only ones. Very soon after, fans, governments, economists, non-involved football bodies and leagues, current and former players, teams and news agencies all got involved. And what was interesting in watching this somewhat universal condemnation of the league was that it looked like everyone had a similar, or albeit overlapping, perspective. Admittedly, they did have slightly different perspectives. I mean, news agencies aren't going to be talking about the economic damage to local communities, because fundamentally didn't interest them. And the method through which they complained differed slightly as well. I mean, again, news agencies have entire programming blocks that they can dedicate to their condemnation of the Super League, whilst I myself only had Twitter's 280 characters to complain through, or if I was feeling very spicy, 1 hour on Instagram Live. As such, the condemnation of the Super League felt cohesive. It felt like a movement, a truly collective and organized effort against something which so many people felt threatened by. And it meant that no matter what your position was in or to the game, whether that was a fan or an owner, a pundit or commentator, the message felt clear. And not only did it feel clear, it felt tailored to you. It felt personal. And in a movement I haven't seen in years, everyone had a reason to disagree with the Super League. For some, it was ideological. For others, it was more personal. I mean, why support a local club if you didn't have bragging rights 2 weeks of the year over your office mate to say that your club was better than theirs? Nevertheless, the European Super League was kind of concluded to be this exclusive, uncompetitive and financially damaging idea, albeit not to the clubs who joined, but to everyone else who couldn't get in. It was damaging to leagues, damaging to players who were no longer eligible to play for their national clubs or able to win the Champions League. Two things which are kind of sold to young players even before they arrive at the academy. Go on to win a World Cup and you go on to be a legend. Win a Euro and you're fantastic. If you win a Champions League, you doesn't even matter if you're European, you're going to go down in the history books. Yet humans aren't a hive mind, thankfully. And the European Super League did have some supporters. Now, these supporters claimed that the European Super League would be a way for clubs to be financially saved fundamentally. During a pandemic, so many had been hit negatively that their investments weren't working out and the financial underpinning of these clubs was in jeopardy. And if these clubs went under, football would soon follow after. Some clubs like Real Madrid and Barcelona were looking at €1 billion of debt. And 300 million wouldn't necessarily save them, but they would be able to make a lot of that money back quite quickly, and they could soon be back in the black. Additionally, for those who had an ideological resistance to the Super League, there was an ideological support of it. Many claimed that UEFA and FIFA were these overtly bureaucratic, soft on racism organizations that these clubs would be better off distancing themselves from. And it forced many people to question, how can something mean so many different things at the same time? How can an idea save football financially whilst damaging it at the same time? How can something be a democratic overhaul whilst being authoritarian in nature? The simple answer is that action network theory allows us to see all things to mean all of their meanings, i.e. the Challenger was both the next step in space exploration, whilst its destruction meant that it showed us that spaceflight was still dangerous and we still had a lot to learn. And in a way, I was motivated to use this theory to map out what football might mean, because fundamentally actor network theory allows us to metaphorically grab hold of the object we want to analyze and turn it over and read the ingredients a bit like, I don't know, 7-Up or Sprite. So what exactly are the physical ingredients to football? Well, we obviously have the more physical things, you know, the rubber, the polyester, the blend stitching, the cowhide leather, and even ink might go into making a ball. We have plastics, concrete, steel, aluminium, glass, grass, and others, things like that make stadiums. Whilst vinyl, plastic, and various polymer mixes, rubber and plastics could make the kits, and that's going from the shirts and gloves to socks and boots and shorts. And whilst this is obviously a simplification, you know, it ignores things like LED scoreboards and how stadium lights might be wired up, or what goes into the referee's whistle, or the book of rules that they remember in order to judge the game. These ingredients show us that football isn't just a thing, it is something made up of many things, and these things come to being through various legislative and business agreements to make the ball, the kits, the stadiums possible. And I referenced the referee's rulebook there because in that respect, something less physical also is an ingredient of football. In this respect, we're talking about the concept of the game or the idea of the game. Because at the heart, football is about a conflict, albeit it's a peaceful conflict, but a conflict nonetheless, where two teams compete and both of them aim to beat the other, or at least they should be. Let's not play for a draw here, people. As such, the rules aim to make the conflict between those two teams fair, and it does this fairness by governing how many players each side get. It talks about what they both aim to do or should aim to do, and sets a challenge as to how these teams complete it. For example, only one player per team who has to be within a certain sized box is allowed to touch the ball with their hands in order to prevent the other team from scoring a goal, which may or may not lead to their inevitable demise. Other rules also aim to protect competitors from being maliciously harmed, and in more recent years, rules have governed how play is conducted off the pitch, governing how finances are regulated or monitored. They talk about how much teams are allowed to be owned and how that ownership model is then baked into the wider football structure. In this respect, we can see that the conflict is only a component of at least organized football, but in order to play, so is compliance. And you might be wondering, how can compliance be an ingredient to the game? Well, think of it this way. If we have one set of teams who only play the ball at their feet, and another team just picks up the ball and runs with it, you effectively have one team complying with the rules playing the game that you have in mind, and another can play in a completely different game, which gives them an unfair advantage. So back on the idea of enforcement. And whilst a ref might run around for 90 minutes each week to make sure that the game is being played without those unfair advantages seeping in, off the pitch enforcement happens through things like sanctions and audits or transfer blockages if you're Chelsea and you go outside the financial fair play rules. And various other methods might be used to justify that bureaucratic structure which was criticised earlier. Now, bureaucratic structures aren't necessarily a bad thing. They enable play to happen at a local, at a league, at a national, continental and international level. Now, the thing is, these formal structures only make up a fraction of the ingredients to football. We have things like time, the dedication required to even get to that sort of level, the skills necessary also, and also a passion for the game are also ingredients, as are non-footballing systems which make those performances possible, i.e. those interpersonal and business, education, medical and fitness personnel, and agreements which I referenced earlier in the creation of stadiums, teams, kits, etc. So what we begin to see here is that traditional football, at least, is a complex concoction of the intangible and physical ideas and concepts and physical things and people all mixed together to create a product that can be consumed by the general public. And this is where we begin to see the overlap between media and football that I mentioned earlier. Because what you might have noticed is that I have already ignored, or at least excluded, the fan experience that makes up football. I've chosen to focus on the structural hierarchy, which enables the game to be played in an organized way. And this intentional oversight is one which is reflected in organized football, especially in England, where we as fans don't have a marginal, let alone controlling, interest in the clubs that we financially support. Instead, we, the fans, are treated like consumers. We pay for the results of a carefully constructed product, and the powers that be allow us to consume this product through other non-democratic systems, such as, you know, TV media companies who host the television rights to these competitions that we so, well, love to watch. So it's perhaps no surprise that some people argued that potentially the reason we felt that the reaction and rejection of the Super League was so cohesive and coherent was because the non-democratic structures and the powers that be were orchestrating a resistance to the European Super League. Fundamentally, if we break it down, we were watching 12 clubs, the most prized possession in UEFA's control, break away from UEFA's sphere of influence. And this power grab would have financial implications. Fundamentally, it would render a lot of the TV rights agreements useless because, again, the most commercially attractive clubs were leaving these agreements to go and create a league elsewhere under their own pretenses and own ownership. And in this resistive act, what we managed to see is the adage that football is more than just football coming true once again. Previously, people have talked about football being like a religion, and I can see how that is somewhat true. We have things like the concept of the game and the spirit of the game, the love of the game, all being poured into this product that we fundamentally can all do ourselves without the need for TV licensing deals, without major club owners, and without clubs themselves. We've also seen how reformative changes to the game, i.e. ones that would allow the game to be more interesting to watch through the changing to the offside rule, or rules which would allow the game's rules to be more easily and consistently enforced through VAR, be heavily contested. And it forces us to revisit this idea of the spirit of the game, right? That religious element to it, which allows the game to be repackaged and resold to people in domestic leagues all over the world, yet all of them having the same emotional attachment to this idea of football and the clubs in which they attach so much of their value to. The mediated product of football allows us to apply so many different theories to how we view football being perceived and received. The representation of football is so different to what we play in our back gardens, our yards, our parks and school playgrounds. Watching a game on television is so different to being there pitch side watching our favourite players kick the ball. There's also a parasocial element to football as well, where we as fans place so much of our personal identity and value onto clubs who have no idea that we even exist or even care that we exist. Yet at the same time, football can be a catharsis, a moment of release for a hard week's work. It can be a way in which our ideological values are expressed and implemented. It's a way in which politics seems relevant to us in a tangible way in an everyday sense. It's a way in which our intersocial and interpersonal interactions make sense, and we can find a way in which they have value. There is so much to football, and Bruno Latour's academic theory allowed me to see this, and in our reaction to the European Super League, I was able to see why our reactions to football are so deep and seemingly ingrained. It's why, at the same time, we can argue that there is an orchestrated reaction to the European Super League, whilst at the same time finding that the reactions and responses to the European Super League are authentic, whether they are negative or positive. And so, what we have seen here today is that our ACT network theories aren't necessarily a moral judgment as to how we begin to know things or know about football. In some ways, active network theory is a good faith interpretation as to how we become to understand and know things. Instead of questioning how we determine something to be true, active network theory assumes that everything we say about something is true, even if those things are contradictory. And in this sense, we begin to see why football can be so disheartening and so uplifting at the same time. It's why you can love a club which you hate. And I do have Arsenal fans in mind when I say that. But that's all I have for this week and for another application of active network theory. Over the summer, you can catch me making live streams on YouTube. Just search Omar Alleyne, that's OmarAlleyne, where we will be revising media theories in more detail than these 20-minute podcasts allow. You can also find me on social media. Again, Omar Alleyne on Twitter, on Instagram, on Vero. You can also find the podcast more accurately as at ACMOAPod on Twitter. And you'll be able to catch me in 2 weeks' time. Hope you enjoy the rest of your bank holiday if you're listening on Monday. Enjoy the rest of your week if you're listening on any other day. Have a fantastic time, people. Stay safe. Take care. Goodbye.